Genesis 12:1 through 14:24, the 15th talk in a series on Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on June 24, 2001 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2001. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
It's been several months since I taught, and I left off at Genesis chapter 11, chapter 12. I'm going to be teaching this Sunday, and then I don't know when I'll be back again. But nevertheless, I'm going to pick up just where I left off as if it was last week. Well, not quite as if it was last week. Let me give you a little bit of a review. Genesis is... I think Genesis is a fascinating book. I've taught through it several times. And every time I work through it, I see things that I hadn't seen before. But it's this story, it's the beginning of history. And history, as I see it, is God's grand novel. History is God telling in the affairs of man, God telling this grand story. And this grand story has two themes. One, and the primary one, I think, is it is giving us an understanding of who God is. That's one main theme. The other main theme is, who is man? And the reason for the second theme, who is man, is it becomes very important in understanding who God is to see God interacting with this creature, man. So God began by creating the universe, and in this universe he created man who is like God and plays the key role in history. He's one of the main characters in this story. But he created man in such a way that we see early on rebelliousness being manifest in man. Man was created in the image of God. There's something about man that is like God. But from chapter 3 on, what we see manifested in man is this desire to be like God in the sense of having his power and his prerogative. But in fact, man was not made to be like God in that sense. Man was made to be like God in a different sense, and that is in being able to exhibit the moral character of God. That's the way in which we were made to be like God. That's the sense in which we were made in the image of God. But instead, man has pretended to the power and authority that God has, and as a result, has been in rebellion against God because the universe is not big enough for two gods. There cannot be two bosses in the universe. So man has turned out to be a rival to God rather than a servant in his behavior and his attitudes. So then what we see that early on in Genesis, and then we see God's attempts to tame that rebellion. And what we see is punishment and threats of punishment don't tame this rebelliousness that's in man. We see that with Cain. Cain was warned that he needed to do what was right, or if he didn't, sin was crouching at the door ready to devour him. and that warning was not adequate. We see later God comes in judgment, destroys all of mankind because of their wickedness and rebelliousness against Him. What's the next thing that we see? We see one of the people that was on the ark that contained the only eight people that survived the flood, that had to know that God is indeed a God of judgment, that he does judge wickedness. And we see Ham demonstrating rebelliousness before the earth is completely dry. So threat and punishment aren't the tools that will work to curb the rebelliousness in man. So the question is, what can be done? What can be done with this rebel man? And it's at that point that Abram emerges as a character in our story. And the significance of Abram is an everyman. There is nothing distinctive about Abram. There's no reason given why God picked him as opposed to anyone else. There's no evidence that there's something uniquely good about Abram. In fact, the record seems to indicate that Abram comes from a family that believed in the gods of Sumer and worshiped the gods of Sumer, and Abram was probably no different from that. So God just picks someone out at random and decides to make that person a demonstration of how this rebelliousness can be curbed. And what he does is he takes Abram out and he blesses Abram and begins to transform his soul and thereby weed out the rebelliousness and build into him a faith and an attitude of service towards God rather than this rebelliousness towards God. So Abram becomes this unique demonstration of the way that this rebelliousness can indeed be curbed. And that's by God entering into someone's life and transforming their soul. So what we see in the story of Abram is, over time, he grows, he matures. He comes to trust God in a way that is, by the end, is truly phenomenal. But at the beginning, he kind of falters and stumbles. The faith does not come naturally. It has to be built into him. And it's interesting to see how God deals with him along the way. In chapter 12, we saw the first instance of Abram stumbling. And that was after God had come to Abram and blessed him and assured him that God was willing to take care of him. That Abram, I think due to drought, went down to Egypt. And there he was afraid that he might lose his life because his wife was so beautiful that someone would want to take his wife away from him, and in order to take her away would kill him. So Abram had a great idea. He would say, "This is my sister rather than my wife," and thereby save his life. But in so doing, the Pharaoh in Egypt wanted Sarah for his wife and took her away from Abram into his harem. But God intervened and sent a plague on Pharaoh and his household, and as a result, Pharaoh returned Sarah to Abram and sent Abram away from Egypt and gave him gifts as a parting present. It's at that point then that we pick up the narrative in chapter 13. Okay, let's read verses 1, let's see, 1 through 7. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him. Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. And he went on his journeys from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been in the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly. And there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. And the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land. Okay. What God did in response to Abram's faithlessness in Egypt is to come to his rescue, and he saved him from a mess, from what could have been a horrible mess. He could have lost his wife to him. They could have been separated forever. But God intervened and made sure that that did not happen. And furthermore, God did so in such a way that Abram was sent away from Egypt with additional wealth. So Abram, although he was faithless, emerges with his family intact. He is sent back to the land that was given to him by God, and he has more wealth than he had before. So God has intervened in such a way that Abram has been preserved, remarkably preserved. So Abram has much to be thankful for. He returns back to the place where he had originally been given the promise of the land of Canaan, a place where he had built an altar and made offerings to God. He returns to that same place, and again he offers his gratitude to God. Okay, but he's emerging wealthy, and he's got the kind of wealth that's difficult because it eats grass. And there's not enough grass. So his wealth has become a problem here. There's a tendency, I think, for us to think of wealth as a problem solver. And there are some problems that wealth can solve. If we don't have much money, we think, well, if we just had money, everything would be solved. If we have some money, we always think that more money would be the thing that would solve everything. And I suspect even if you have a lot of money, you think, if I only had more money, it would solve everything. But I think anyone realizes on more sober reflection that if you have money, it just means you have a different set of problems. It's not like it's a universal problem solver. It just changes the problems. You have a different set of problems. If any of you have played the game that I have played, what if I won the lottery? I went through one day, it was kind of an interesting experience, thinking, let's see, if I won the lottery, what would I do with it? And I began by dividing it up very magnanimously. And then I thought about it later and I refined it. No, it'd be better to do it this way and this way. A little bit later, I was making other adjustments. And then towards the end of the day, I was thinking, well, let's see. If I won that much money, then we'd have to start locking the doors to our house. And then I started thinking, you know, if we had that much money, then we'd have to worry about our kids being kidnapped. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, my goodness, what a blessing that I didn't win the lottery. If you really think about it soberly, it's just a different set of problems. It's not that all problems are removed by money. You're just trading in for another set of problems. And that was the experience here with Abram. His wealth has created a different set of problems. It hasn't solved all problems. Now, why would God make him wealthy? God has blessed Abram. But I think we would all acknowledge that wealth is not the ultimate blessing. If wealth is the only blessing that God is bringing to Abram, this is not a great blessing. So why does God make Abram wealthy? I don't know the answer to that question. It doesn't give us the answer to that question. I can only speculate as to what that answer would be. But I think the answer is the wealth is an outward sign of a more significant blessing that is taking place. Let's do a little thought experiment here. Let's pretend that I am a faith healer. And I pick one of you out and say, I have detected that you have a brain tumor. And then I pray that that brain tumor be removed. And after the prayer, I assure you that that brain tumor has been removed. How many are impressed? That's not a very impressive demonstration, because there's no way to know whether there was a tumor there to start with and whether the tumor was removed afterwards. But let's change it a little bit. Now, I tell you that you've got a brain tumor, and I'm going to pray for that brain tumor to be removed. But at the time that the tumor disappears, your hair will change to bright green. Now I pray, and your hair changes to bright green. Now are you impressed? That's different. Because there's something tangible, there's something that I can actually see that's happened. It may not be significant that the hair has turned to bright green. It may be significant. But it may not be significant. But it's just a demonstration that there's some tangible evidence that a significant thing has happened. And I think that's the kind of thing we're looking at here with Abram. God has made him wealthy, not because wealth is a great blessing, but rather because this is something that everyone can see. And this is a sign of the more significant thing that's taking place. And that's the blessing of God entering into his life and transforming his soul. In any case, he did make him wealthy, and the wealth created problems. Because this wealth eats grass, and because there wasn't much grass where they were, we've got Lot and we've got Abram, and their wealth is both competing for the same grass. And as a result, as is the case with human beings, tension arose between the two sides. Who's going to get the grass? And it is a problem. It's the first evidence that we have seen of a problem between Abram and his nephew Lot. And this is an unfortunate development. Let's read on. Verse 8-13. Then Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right, or if to the right, then I will go to the left." And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, and Lot settled in the cities of the valley, and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly, and sinners against the Lord. Okay, we've got the problem, too little grass, too many animals. What are we going to do? Abram says, it is not worth it to have these tensions between me and my kinsmen. Let us take action to remove this cause of friction between us. So Abram's solution is to turn to Lot and say, you know, we need to separate here. For the sake of our relationship, we need to separate. Now you choose where you would like to go, and I will take the other place. Abram has a freedom at this point that is truly enviable. God has demonstrated his loyalty to Abram. God has protected Abram. And Abram has learned from that. And now he looks at this situation and he says, you know, the more important thing is to preserve this relationship. That is what's really important here. And I don't have to look out for my best interests, because God has demonstrated his willingness to look out for my best interests. It does not matter whether I end up on desert land or whether I end up on green pasture, God will take care of me. So Abram has an enormous amount of freedom here. He can say, Lot, take your choice. God will take care of me in any case, so you pick whichever you want. Lot then looks out at his choices. It's a no-brainer. There's lots of grass down in the valley. It's well-watered. And well-watered is important in this part of the world. It's well-watered. That means there'll be lots of grass down there. And up on the hill where they're standing, it's sparse. It's kind of like Eastern Oregon. So it's a no-brainer, is it not? We know, however, there is an ominous statement in here, verse 15, now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. And if you know the story as it progresses, Lot's choice ended up being the worse of the two options. It didn't look like that at the time. But there are other factors that came into play which made that the worst choice, actually. And in fact, as we proceed through life, it seems to me that most of the decisions that I make, I am aware, I have become aware, that the obvious good choice is not necessarily in the long run the good choice. The fact is, we don't know much. There is an enormous amount that we do not know. So whenever we make a decision, we're making it on severely limited information. There are always critical things that we don't know about that we cannot take into account when we make the decision. God is in much better position to make those choices. And it's important to recognize that it's not always the no-brainers aren't always the right choices. So Lot picks the well-watered valley. He moves into the plains, and he moves his tents as far as Sodom. So what we're going to see in Lot is a very tragic situation in which he becomes enculturated in a part of that wicked culture, and we'll see that later in Genesis. There is in these verses a sense of tragedy that it's not well reflected in the English translation. It says in verse 13:11, very literally, they separated each man from his brother. There's a sense of tragedy here that our own sinfulness, our own petty concerns that create tensions that ought not be there. There's no real reason for them, and yet they creep into all of our relationships. And it crept into the relationship between Abram and Lot to such an extent that it was better for them to separate to alleviate those tensions than to stay together and allow those tensions to create even greater problems between them. So this is happening with, there's a sense of tragedy that's kind of underlying this. It's a shame that this is what it came to, but this is what it came to. Verses 14 through 18. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes and look toward the place where, look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see I will give to you and to your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and its breadth, for I will give it to you." And then Abram moved from his tent and came to dwell by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. God enters in at this point after Abram has made this decision to let Lot choose first in order to save their relationship. God then comes to Abram and repeats essentially the blessing that he had placed on Abram before. It is a pattern with Abram, with God's dealing with Abram, that when Abram is faithful, God then comes to him and gives him reassurance and further blessing. Okay, chapter 14. This is an interesting account. Before we read it, this is the first event in Genesis that historians are hopeful, some are hopeful, some are not, that it may be datable and there may be support that is extra biblical, because we have the names of some nations and some kings that maybe at some point there will be corroboration from extra biblical sources. There was a discovery in Syria, it was probably 20 years ago now, at Ebla, where they discovered an archive. And in translating some of the documents in that archive, it was at one time believed that they had found one or two of these names in those documents. But since then, that has been called into question. So, and the materials from Ebla have been caught up in political issues, and so that stuff is not coming out and being published as rapidly as might otherwise be expected. So at this point, to my knowledge, none of these kings or places have, none of these events in chapter 14 have been corroborated by extra-biblical sources, but there's hope that someday maybe they will. Read the first 12 verses. And it came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, the king of Elisar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Gaim, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemember, the king of Zebaim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these came as allies to the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but the 13th year they rebelled. And in the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and defeated the Rephaim at Ashtaroth Kernaim, and the Zuzim in Ham, and the Amim in Havah Havi Kiryathayim. And the Horites in their Mount Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and conquered all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites who lived in Hazazon Tamar, and the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zebaim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, came out. And they arrayed for battle against them in the valley of Siddim, against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Gaim, and Amraphel, the king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them. But those who survived fled to the hill country. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. And they also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. Okay, here's the situation. There are 4 kings coming from the east in Mesopotamia. Now, apparently, one of these kings had come 12 years earlier, 13 years earlier, and conquered all of these cities in Palestine. These cities being, well, there are a number of cities in Palestine, but including Sodom and Gomorrah. So apparently he'd come 13 years earlier, conquered those areas, then returned with the agreement that those cities in Palestine would send a certain amount of tribute every year. Because if they didn't pay the tribute every year, then those kings would come back and pillage and plunder and get their money that way. So they could do it one way or the other, but they were going to pay up. And they would suffer less if they just paid the tribute. This was common practice in the area at this time. Nothing really surprising. Also common practice, since they are a long ways away from Mesopotamia, it would be a big trip for those kings to come out and conquer them. The kings of the cities in Palestine were waiting for a time when they thought that they could get away with no longer paying the tribute. They listen to news reports and watch for signs that the power of those kings in Mesopotamia is weakening. And if they see that it's weakening, then they'll say, we aren't sending tribute this year. We can get away with it. So in the 13th year, they decided the kings in the east are weak. They wouldn't be able to mount an expedition and come out and beat up on us, so we aren't sending tribute this year. And they got away with it 1 year. But the next year, Chedorlaomer and his allies, they came out to collect. And when they collect big time, because they had to go through all the hassle of having to put together an expedition, taking their time out from playing golf and come into Palestine and beat up on these people. So they're going to collect big time. They come out, and apparently there are quite a few cities in Palestine that owed tribute. And if you were to look on your map, the path that they follow is here's the Jordan. They come down this side of the Jordan, the Transjordan. They conquer the cities on the highlands on the east side of the Jordan. They go all the way down south into El Paran and Mount Seir, and then they double back and come up to the southern part of Palestine to Kadesh, and then finish things off by moving into the valley of the Dead Sea. They're going to take care of the cities there, and then they're going to head back. So that seems to be their route. They have successfully done all of that up to the point of arriving to the valley of the Dead Sea. So now it's time to collect from the kings there. The kings there have created an alliance of five city-states, and they are going to take their stand against Kedol Omar and his allies. It doesn't sound like it was a very even contest. Kedol Omar routs the cities of the plains quite easily, and it is a little humorous, I suppose, that the fate of the kings of the city is that they fell in the tar pits, because this is their home turf. If anybody should know where the tar pits are, it should be the people that live there. And yet they fall in their own tar pits, which proves they're city folk. The Canaanites generally were urban. Sodom and Gomorrah were very urban civilizations. And it is quite likely that they did not go out into the countryside much. They're city folk. So when this happens, they fall in the tar pits that they should have known about if they had been out and about in their territory. Verses 13 through 16. Then a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. Now he was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and brother of Aner, and these were allies with Abram. And when Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained man, born in his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions, and also the women and the people. Now when Kedol Omar and his allies had conquered Sodom and Gomorrah, they took everything of value. Probably piled it all into wagons, and they're starting to cart that stuff back home to Mesopotamia. And included in the stuff that they took was a number of people, probably going back to be slaves. And among those people that were being taken away were Lot and his family. So some of the people who flee from this battle make their way to the hill country and inform Abram of what has happened. And Abram decides, I'm going to the rescue of my nephew. Now, Kedol Omar and his forces have already demonstrated that they are a power. There has been no one in Palestine that's been able to stand up to them. And now they're headed back victorious. Abram, with just a handful of men, he's got 318. I don't know if that's just what he's contributing, and you have to add to that the men that his allies are bringing, or whether the 318 is supposed to include the whole force. It looks to me like it's 318 plus his friends. But in any case, it's a relatively small force. But he's decided that he is going to go and he's going to rescue his nephew from the fate of being taken into slavery. And apparently, he is expecting God to come and help him in this effort. He takes off. He catches up with them at Dan. If you look at your map, Dan would be, it's near the Sea of Galilee, or the Sea of Chinnereth. He meets them there. They divide their forces. They don't have a lot to divide, but they divide their forces and attack them during the night and chase them as far as Damascus. So they chase them a long ways. So Abram is victorious in defeating this large force. Now, it is possible that Abram was not fighting against the whole force. It is possible that Kedol Omar has decided, we have routed all of our enemies, We need to get back quickly. And just left a small force behind bringing the possessions because those are going to move more slowly. The text doesn't say that. There's no indication in the text that that's the case. But it's possible there's something like that that has happened. In any case, Abram is surprisingly victorious, at least to all, humanly speaking. This is a surprising victory. Abram and his forces rout Chedorlaomer's forces, and they're able to get all of the possessions and bring those back, including Lot and all the people that were taken captive. Okay, the last section. Then after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him a tenth of all. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, Give the people to me and take the goods for yourself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their share. Okay, we have this strange event. There are a number of strange events in Genesis. This is just another one of them. We have this character Melchizedek who shows up, and he is one of two people that come out on the same plain, same in the same valley, to meet Abram as he's returning. Now, more is said about Melchizedek in Hebrews, where it talks about Jesus being a priest in the order of Melchizedek. And it points out that in Genesis, Melchizedek has no genealogy. And the point there seems to be, here we have a priest of the Most High God who became a priest not because of whom he was born to, but on some other basis. As you'll remember, as the nation of Israel comes into being, it's the descendants of Aaron that are priests before God. And how is it that they become priests? They become priests by being born to that family. So it's by birth that they have the status of being a priest. What's different about Melchizedek is his priesthood, according to the narrative in Genesis, is not based on who he was born to. It's not based on genealogy. He's a priest on some other basis. The other thing that's pointed out is that there's no indication that Melchizedek's priesthood has an ending to it. Now, this one's a little harder for me to understand. The first one, that he is a priest on some other basis, that makes sense to me. This one, I have a harder time understanding how the author of Hebrews is able to make that point out of Genesis. But in any case, his observation is there's no record in Genesis of Melchizedek's reign as priest coming to an end. And then he likens that to Jesus. In any case, this Melchizedek is a curious figure. This is the only place that he shows up in the narratives. He is referred to in a couple of the Psalms, and then he's talked about in Hebrews. But he does not show up in any other part of the historical narrative. We don't know whether Abram knew Melchizedek before this event, or whether they were ignorant of each other. But in any case, there is this figure, this fellow who is both the king of Salem, which is later becomes Jerusalem, the king of Salem, and Salem means peace, and he is a priest of the Most High God, and the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness, I believe. This character, for what Abram has been able to accomplish. So he comes out in the valley presenting bread and wine and offers a blessing then on Abram in the name of the Most High God, and then offers a blessing to the Most High God himself. Here is apparently then someone who is a kindred spirit with Abram, that somehow he recognizes that the God that's behind Abram, the God that Abram serves, is the same God that I serve. And he's there at the culmination of this event, and he sees God's hand in it, and he's there to offer praise and gratitude to God and thanks to Abram. So that's one person that meets him in the valley. The other person that meets him in the valley is the king of Sodom. And the king of Sodom is there with a different orientation. The king of Sodom is there to make sure he gets what is his. Now, what Sodom says is not outrageous, and there's a sense in which the king of Sodom is being... I mean, the king of Sodom could have come and said, Abram, give us back everything that was taken from us. But that's not what the king of Sodom says. The king of Sodom says, you can have all the stuff, just return the people. So there's a sense in which he's not being as grabbing as he could have been. I am not up on the rules of pillage and plunder, but I think that by all rights, everything belonged to Abram. But the king of Sodom probably had no claim to anything. But I don't know that for sure. In any case, what he asks for is the people back. He says Abram can have the possessions. Abram's response is, no thanks. Abram knows what kind of person the king of Sodom is. And not so much what kind of person the king of Sodom is. Abram knows what kind of society Sodom is. And Abram takes the perspective, I don't want any of it. Because if I were to take any of it, it could be said that my blessing came at the expense of Sodom and its people. That my wealth, my well-being, is because I stole it from the people of Sodom. And Abram says, I don't want my well-being to be in any way attributable to that which came from Sodom. So he says, take it all. Take the people, take the stuff, take it all. The only thing that I will claim is my per diem and the portion that goes to my allies. They have their right to it. I can't give up their right to it. Let them have what is rightly their share. But I don't want my share. But apparently, prior to making that agreement with the king of Sodom, he had already given one-tenth to the king, to Melchizedek, in recognition of the position that Melchizedek held as a priest of the Most High God, and in recognition of the fact that Abram's success was due directly to God's hand in helping him and making it possible for him to defeat this army. So as a result of this series of events in which Abram saw his nephew being taken away to what could have been a horrible fate, Abram decided that he was going to do whatever he could to try to save his nephew from that fate. He took a big risk, and he went out against this big army, but with God's help, was successful, defeated them, and was able to bring all of those possessions back, but more importantly, was able to free Lot from that fate. So we see here Abram beginning to take to heart, it seems to me, the fact that God has guaranteed him that he is going to look out for Abram's well-being and best interests. And Abram acts in a very virtuous manner in going to save his nephew, and God comes to his aid and makes sure that he is successful. So we're beginning to see Abram develop a faith and trust in God that was not there from the beginning, but God is coming in and building it into his life through a series of experiences, rather remarkable experiences, and he slowly over time makes Abram into the kind of person that trusts God implicitly, who has the kind of freedom to say, I don't have to look out for my own best interests. I can look out for the interests of those around me. I can care about the interests of those around me because I'm in good hands. I'm taken care of. And that is a kind of freedom that is unbeatable. That is a kind of freedom that may God grant us all. It really is an amazing freedom. Any questions or comments?
The comment on the garden. What was that?
Come on up.
Let's look at this together here. In verse...
the Garden of the Lord and the Garden of Egypt.
Bingo.
That's... It's too bad you asked that question. I thought about it, but I'm not sure... I'm not sure why that's there. Where it talks about it being like Egypt, that's a little ominous, actually, because we associate Egypt with the upcoming slavery. We associate Egypt with that place that Abram just returned from, which is not entirely a virtuous place. So that's a little ominous. Now, the Garden of the Lord, that apparently is referring to Eden, the Garden of Eden at the time of creation. There is another reference to the Garden of the Lord, and I'm trying to remember where that is. It is in talking about, I think it's talking about the king of Sire who had... King of Tyre, that had his land was like unto the garden of the Lord. And in that context, if I'm remembering correctly, in that context, it's talking about the king of Tyre as being one who is proud and arrogant and pretends to God-like power and prerogative. And he has this land that is like the garden of the Lord. So there, the sense is, this is this beautiful place that someone with arrogance has grasped, has taken into his possession. So I think in both cases, likening that valley to the Garden of the Lord and the Valley of Egypt, in both cases, they're kind of tainted imagery, that there's something ominous about this. It looks good, but there's something ominous about it. But that's the best I can do right now.
Could you comment on how you understand their what common ground Abraham and the rest of believers stand in, as well as the level, the kind of expectation that Adam, that Abraham had in terms of, I'm interested in you talking also more about what the implications of a promise are, and that seems like it might be similar and different in our situation and his. Could you comment on those?
Yes, remind me which ones, as I go down, which ones I have commented on. What common ground do we share with Abram? It's the same God, and we are the same kind of people. And I think what we see happening that is the same is God has entered into Abram's life, and he has decided that he is going to transform Abram and make him no longer a rebel, but a servant of God. And he does that not because of anything that Abram has done, but just because God picked him. And God just kind of plops himself down next to Abram and says, I'm going to bless you. And begins to work in the transformation of his very soul. So that Abram comes to the place where he truly trusts God with his well-being. Now we share common ground in that's the story of the gospel. That's the story of salvation. That for everyone who's a believer, God is coming to them and is essentially saying, I am going to bless you. And I am going to transform you. I'm going to take you from being a rebel, and I am going to make you into a servant of mine. And it's going to take time. There will be failures along the way. But what I'm going to do is to teach you that I can be trusted implicitly. I am going to teach you that I have your best interests in heart. I will take care of you. And so you can let go of that grasping to save your own life. And so there are promises that God is making to Abram that go beyond any promises that he's made to us. He has not promised us land. He has not promised us descendants that are more numerous than the sand. But he is doing the same thing in our lives with respect to the transformation of our soul that he is doing with Abram. I'm convinced it's the same process. Okay, what was your next question? What was the next part?
Well, you kind of commented on it, but expectations or what's inherent or how we should understand promises. Mm-hmm. You kind of commented on that.
Right. If God makes a promise, we can count on it, but we have to make sure that the promise has been made to us. Just because God makes a promise doesn't mean that we are going to get it. If God makes a promise to Abram, that doesn't mean that I am going to get it. What God has promised to us as believers is that He will bring us to righteousness. He will make us righteous people. And that He will look out for our best interests. We can count on both of those promises. Now, our best interests include a lot of pain. That's the way God has created the world, is that there is a lot of good that comes from us suffering pain. We learn a lot through that process. We learn a lot about ourselves. We learn a lot about God. And we can see in Abram's life that he experienced a number of very painful situations. But God was looking out for his best interests. That in the long run, Abram was a better man for having gone through those experiences. So we can count on God's promise that he will look out for our best interests. That does not mean that life will go smoothly. That's a different issue. Life will probably go along messily, but that's what it takes. Because in the long run, that's better for us. There are things that we need to learn that we can only learn through suffering. So those are promises made. We can count on those promises. We just have to understand the nature of those promises and not expect something other than what has been promised. Now, was there another part of your question? I thought there was a third.
If there was, I
okay.
I can't remember it. Okay. And if somebody else has a question, I don't want to take up more, but I'll ask it, and then if you want to go on to somebody else, because there are other hands, I haven't been looking, you can go on, I'll let you decide.
Go ahead.
How do you talk to your children about really bad, hard things happening to them that don't have to do with, like, a choice of theirs?
Mm-hmm.
And how they should consider God and what his promises mean and what they can expect and what really we haven't been given the information to think that we could expect? I know it's a big question, and if it's mm-hmm. too much, I understand.
When kids are really little, that's a hard thing. That's kind of hard to work through. But what I have done with our kids is to talk about hard things are to be expected. To think that life is going to be a period of time in which hard things don't happen, that's living in a fantasy. Realistically, hard things will happen. They do to everyone. But that just because hard things happen, that doesn't mean that God is not good. And when they're really young, most of what I've done is just reassured them that God is a loving God, and try to look at how, in the long run, some of those hard things may have good benefits, that some good things have come out of that. As they get older, that becomes easier. They're capable of seeing that. And we have actually our children up to this point have been blessed with just the right amount of hardship. I mean, even I can see that life has not been just one huge hardship. There has been a lot of good in it for my kids up to now, but there have been very hard things that have come along. And with each of those, we've talked with our kids about it and to try to help them to get perspective on it. Oftentimes, it's not as bad as they think it is. And oftentimes, they're focusing on part of it that is not really the bad part, but somewhere else is really the bad part. But then we've tracked the progress of those things, and over time have been able to see how those have had really positive benefits. And the kids have recognized that. In life, we can't expect that in every case, hard times will have benefits that we can see. It is a blessing from God when they have those kinds of benefits that even we can see. But in a number of instances, our children have been blessed with situations in which hard times over 1 or 2 years have had visibly good benefits, and we've talked about those quite a bit. Those have been excellent lessons.
Thanks.
One more, and then I gotta quit.
Just a quick comment. It's interesting that each time Abram hears from the Lord, shortly thereafter, he stops and builds an altar, and he worships God. And maybe that's all there is to say about that, but I thought I'd put that out there.
Right. That's very important, because you can see that Abram is understanding what's going on. And how God is indeed blessing him and transforming his life. That's something that's clearly a part of Abram's thinking. It's not like, I was thinking about this, it's not like a professional football player who just wins the Most Valuable Player Award or something and says, stands up before the mic and says, I thank God and all that sort of thing. But you know he doesn't mean it. It's more superstition than it is real gratitude. But on Abram's part, I think we see real gratitude. He really understands that this is attributable to God and not to him. So that is significant. Okay, thanks.